Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Josh Burchick, 20 years of career and volunteer experience, a floating captain with Howard County Fire Rescue in Maryland. I was fortunate to be able to meet Josh at the 2024 Training Days on the Road in Greensboro a few weeks back, where he presented a fantastic presentation on RIT/Mayday and being overall fit for duty. The conversation Josh and I had was very informative, insightful, and should make us all think as firefighters what we can do to improve and be better, but also the very real and true realities of the job when it comes to actually facing a Mayday situation within our own department. With that, I present Mr. Josh Burchick.
Hey man, so I'm Josh Burchick, and I've been in the fire service for 20 years. I'm in my 20th year now.
Okay. First of all, thank you for coming on. Getting ready to talk some shop, getting ready to talk some good stuff in this interview today. If you would, can you tell the listeners exactly how you got into the fire service?
Yeah, man. Well, first and foremost, dude, thanks so much for having me. Super cool opportunity. And it was awesome meeting you in North Carolina. I got into the fire service, started in high school. I wanted to get into volunteering in my local community because I was involved in some nasty situations where I was able to keep a cool head. And I thought, you know, maybe I might have a knack for this. Had a friend who was in a really nasty ATV accident. We were way back in these trails, and remember he actually flipped a four wheeler, and the thing like flipped up in the air, landed on his head. I mean, broke most of his face, jaw. I mean, blood pouring out. And we were there with like a half a dozen other people. Some of the first people that got to him, I mean, like dry heaving from just the, yeah, it's a gruesome scene. Right. And, so they actually dropped him, and then me and another guy run up, and we were able to, like, you know, we're 16, 17 years old, make decisions, calm everybody down, protect him as much as we knew how to with whatever limited, you know, first aid we had.
Right.
And we were able to get him back to, the house where we were staying. And then he ended up getting, medevaced out. By the Maryland State Trooper helicopter system or whatever. And then I had another friend who fell from almost a second story banister inside of her home. And kind of the same thing happened. There were people that, I mean, the blood and body parts and stuff like just really bothered them. And me and another guy she's going in and out of consciousness. We were able to get her to the local volunteer firehouse, and they took care of her. She had both people had like long rehabs. But it started getting me thinking, like, you know, I'm keeping a cool head in some of these situations when everybody's freaking out, like maybe I got a knack for this kind of thing. And that's when it kind of got put on my radar. So, joined the volunteer house, and, I actually started thinking about the EMS side of thing, maybe paramedic, missed all those classes. So they dropped me into fire. I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is a thing. So, once I got into all that, man, that's when, I mean, no pun intended, the fire was lit. You know, I started taking the classes. I joined up, most of my career and degree started focusing on that. And, the rest is kind of history. You know, I volunteered for a while. I was very fortunate that right out of high school, while I was in college, I got the call to come back and start an academy and get hired by the professional side of the service. Did the 6-month academy, and the rest is kind of history right here in Central Maryland.
Okay. From your presentation that I saw while I was up in Greensboro, I truly believe that the department and the people you surround yourself with can make or break the firefighter. And you were around what I call some heavy hitters, because you were on Kentland for a little bit, right?
Yeah. I was, one of the guys I went to the academy with was an officer down there. And one day, shout out Dan Simon, amazing guy. He said, hey man, you want to take a field trip? And so we went down to Kentland, and I was active down there from like 2005 to almost 2010-ish. I never formally changed my address. You know, I wasn't necessarily live in, but I spent more time there than at my career firehouse or even at my personal home for a handful, couple years. And then, you know, met my wife and kids came into the picture, but I spent like a good solid 5 years down there. And that was, rubbed some elbows with amazing, amazing men and learned an incredible amount. And it's a place like no other. So yeah, that was instrumental in giving me some skills and mindset and being able to lean on the guys who'd been there a really long time. Just a, yeah, phenomenal experience.
I can only imagine talking to different dudes that have gone through there. You know, they all say you can't beat the experience. You can't beat the call volume. You can't beat the people that are there who actually love the job, love the craft. And it's just, it's very contagious and passionate.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I almost call it like an immersion program. Like if you're going to like a language school or like with some specialty school, man, you're getting inundated and you definitely have to have the bandwidth and the wherewithal to be able to withstand it. And there are some strong personalities there too, that you have to learn how to deal with. The community, socioeconomically depressed community by and large. But yeah, the call volume, the fire volume, the shootings, the stabbings, like it's all there. And you have to learn to manage that, you know, as a young guy without a whole lot of experience, man. It was like kind of drinking through a fire hose, you know. It was a lot getting thrown at you at once, you know, engine, rescue engine, tower ladder. You had to hold your weight across a couple of disciplines also. And I'm just so fortunate that there were guys there. I mean, life members, I mean, OGs that were there that really would take you under their wing and be like, hey, we're doing this today. And when you were just so busy, you couldn't, then you're using those calls and incidents to build that skill set and experience. So it's something that I certainly take with me, incredibly valuable. I'm still really close with a handful of the guys there, you know, some lifelong friends and mentors, man. It's a place like no other for sure.
All right. For those that don't know, can you tell us a little bit about Howard County, the size, how many stations, personnel, things of that nature?
Yeah. So Howard County, central Maryland, like centrally located. It is one of the smaller counties. So we have, we're up to 14 firehouses now slated with another 1 to 2 coming online. We work a 24/48 schedule. We're about a 600, mid 600s member department, or local 2000, or I think we're over 500 members now. And there's a career presence in all the firehouses. There's some career only, some of them are combination. And for a small department, it's a neat place because we have a little bit of everything. Our one border is Baltimore County. You know, we have run with Baltimore City. Sometimes we cover them on their major incidents. One of our box series used to have a Baltimore City engine on the first alarm. I think they were like 4-2 wagon. And then DC's, you know, 20 minutes to the south. I joke that's without traffic because traffic around here is horrible, right? But, and then just being where we are at, we have, if I float into our lower southeast end, I can be in 5 different jurisdictions all in the same shift, running mutual aid. So it's a wild place. It's definitely a wild place. It's pretty neat that one of the zip codes in Howard County is one of the wealthiest in the nation. But then we still have routes 95, route 1, route 70 cutting through us. So we have our cases of human trafficking. We have our drug issues. We have our human urban development, like Section 8 type developments and homes. There's a lot of history there for being an up and coming department. So we could be anywhere from a 15,000 square foot mansion to rural water, to hydrants on every corner, to HUD urban development housing and apartments, 14 stories, high rise, garden apartments, single families, duplexes, like all of it, all within one first due. Like it's a wild, wild mix. And that was part of the Jim Rouse planned community back in the 70s that really spurred a lot of that. So it's a really interesting place to work. We have Metro, we have rural. We're comprised of 3 battalions. So our West End battalion is more the rural side. But then we have the commercial, the warehouses, like we get tossed everything. So it's a pretty interesting place to work.
Okay. And what's your staffing like on your apparatus?
We are now up to four on all engines and ladders, and every firehouse has a paramedic ambulance in it, and there's a couple that have some BLS ambos in there too, but everything's staffing minimum is four.
Minimum four. Okay. And is it required, are your firefighters required ALS or BLS?
So we have to be at least an EMT basic,
Okay.
and then you have the ability to take your paramedic and go ALS if you'd like to. We even have our own in-house program, or you can come from other programs, and there's incentives for that. But at a minimum, everybody's got to be an EMT. And 80%, like a lot of places, of our call volume is EMS, with the other 10 to 20 being, the rest of the complement.
Okay. And does Howard County do their own transport?
So we have our own transport system. We have Howard County General that's within Howard County. And then outside of that, a lot of our places are like Anne Arundel going towards Annapolis, the state capital. We have a lot of transports that go out towards Baltimore County and Baltimore City. We have Shock Trauma, which is kind of world renowned now. But yeah, we do all of our own transports.
Okay. And for promotion, is it required that you have to be you have to be a paramedic or no?
No requirement for that, but we do have a pretty lengthy document that puts out minimums for promotion. So if you want to be a lieutenant, you have to have at least 4 years on. You have to have college education. There's a lot of the Maryland certifications, which we call MFRE. There's a lot of those certifications that are involved that cover fire officer and building construction and things like that. And then each step you go, there's more requirements. Like at a certain point, there's associates and bachelor's degrees involved. Higher credentialing and certification levels for that. Not to get too deep in the weeds, that actually has caused a lot of issues for our promotional test, because there are so many requirements that, and especially with the college education for some men and women, it's been a heavy lift to try to get those certifications in a timely manner. And we've been operating under the system now, I think it's 10 years. And lieutenant's not as hard, but definitely captain, battalion chief, it gets hard, and our pool gets really small. We run out of officers on our promotional list quite often, almost every time, more so for captain and battalion, even sometimes the assistant chief. Lieutenants, we have a pretty good list. Drivers, pretty good list, but it's also handcuffed us a little bit as well.
Okay. With that, I've kind of segues to a perfect topic of service, education, or experience. And in your opinion, which one outweighs the other?
Yeah, so that's a it's always a nuanced question, right? I think experience is always king. You go to any industry, and they will also, or excuse me, always harp on how much experience that they would like you to have coming into that job on top of certifications, right? And sometimes it is hard to get that experience. There are also people that continue to run fires and the crazy calls, and they don't have that mindset to where they're doing their own like personal review. It's that individual leadership where they're not taking that call, learning from it, and then using that for the next time, right? But the more experience you get, ideally for most people, I think that that is a that is king. One of my good friends that we work with, his name's Tim Daly. OG, one of the best drivers out there that you could ever imagine. He's a PG County chief from back in the day. He's got a great analogy where he talks about the filing cabinet, and you got your drawers of the filing cabinet, the bottom being experience, the top being the training and certifications. If you fill up the top part of that filing cabinet and you have nothing in the experience bank to hold that down, that being the foundation, that filing cabinet is going to topple right over. But the heavier that experience cabinet is to root that foundation and have you have that strong base, that's going to keep that everything else solid, where you don't have to always rely on the training and education piece. And that really spoke to me and a lot of people, where the education is going to trump certifications and training oftentimes. So it's good to have it. We all need it. I'm okay with credentials, but we can't lose sight of what this job is. And it's a dirty thing. Humans are very messy, right? We can be. And so I think that when we are truly keeping an open mindset and learning from these calls and getting out on the street, that takes precedence over just about anything else, in my opinion, right? Service and actual time on, it means something. It absolutely means something. I believe in seniority, but you got to earn it. Simply put, like you can't just say I have 20 years on and then it's owed to you, right? You don't necessarily deserve it unless you have earned it. And I think it does mean something. We used to actually have points for promotion if you were senior and had seniority points. That has since gone away, right, wrong, or indifferent. But then there's also the senior people that they've just repeated the same year, you know, that first year 20 times, and they might rest their head on that a little too much, right? I think the good senior people are still earning it every day. So it means something. I think generally that with experience kind of go hand in hand. You know, you got more time on the street, but you have to have been of value for that to be a thing, right? So yeah, experience, then service closely second that. Training certifications are good, but that's third in my book.
Okay. All right. And at what point in your career in Howard did something click, or have you always wanted to be at least so far like a captain?
Yeah, man. When I first got into the fire service, I was like, man, I could probably really do something with this. You know, I've been in very informal leadership positions with hobbies and sports as I was growing up. And I was thinking, you know, maybe I'll have a knack for that one day, maybe go somewhere in the chief level. And as I got into it, I was like, man, I really love operations. And not saying you can't be a chief and not be involved in operations, but like when I retire, I really want to retire out of a firehouse, not out of a headquarters spot, right? That's what speaks to me personally. And man, it took me, I didn't start promoted, like taking promotional tests until I was like 7 years in, and I didn't get promoted until I was, I think 8 or 9 years in.
Okay.
Overall, I think is what it was. And for me, actually just kind of spoke on this with a couple other people. I think at least maybe it's in my area that some people get a little disgruntled about the other leaders, right? We kind of create a little bit of otherism. Or, you know, I've had a chief tell me like, hey, I got the best argument to end all arguments for promotion. You should promote. Here it is. Like, do you want to work for that guy? Or don't you think you can do a better job than that person? And there's like maybe a shred of value there or some honesty. But honestly, like that's a poor argument to me. I don't like that argument. I think it has to be individually based, and it's about what you can give back. So when I felt like I was in a position where, okay, I think I got enough experience and enough trust and rapport to be able to give back to a team, to help build a team, to help build and nurture others so we can give back to the community. It's that just service-driven purpose. I was like, okay, that's what speaks to me. And that's when I was like, okay, I think I can do that. Let me put my name in the hat and start preparing for the lieutenant rank. And kind of the same thing with captain. Once I was like, you know what, I've done the lieutenant thing for a little while. I can take that next step. That really first step for us is what's management. You kind of toe the line between the battalion chief and then just being a shift supervisor. It's a little bit more of a middle ground. There's a couple more positions you can get into, more command driven. I was like, I think I can still give back to like a battalion and a department and yeah, lead and build teams. And so that's what spoke to me. It wasn't about how I was in competition with other people. That's not a good argument in my book. It's like, it's, what am I able to give? How am I to be of service to this department and community? And I think when we reflect on that a little bit more, I think we're going to have some stronger leaders out there.
I've heard that. You don't know how many times I hear that. Do you really want to work for this person? Or
all the time, man, right?
And it's like, I get it. Most people will probably be like, no, but is that a good enough reason to want to do it? Like, I totally get where you're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we all hear it. I think it's super common in the service, right? Yeah. It's just not what spoke to me. I didn't like it. I kind of wanted to flip that conversation on its head a little bit. So that's what worked for me. And that's how I kind of assign those values for me personally. And when somebody asks them, that's the answer I give. Like, what are you able to give back? You know, don't worry about other people. Don't worry about me. Don't worry about that guy. It's not about that. What are you able to give?
Kind of this question is like for the future, but where would you like to, I know you said you want to end your career in a firehouse, but in
yeah.
what sort of position and what capability do you see yourself in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy running calls. I really do. Even those nights when I get beat up, there's not anything else I'd rather do. Even when I'm dragging myself home and my kids are like, "You okay, Dad?" Yeah, I would, right now I'm in that flow position. I would like to just stay in the company on the firehouse floor, you know, in leading a firehouse, right? Leading a shift and doing that side of it. I've been on engine companies probably a little bit longer, or actually a combination of being in a, excuse me, like a shared status between like engine and truck. I really enjoyed truck work. I've done it a long time. I can see myself eyeing up some of the ladder truck positions in the department. But if I'm on an engine or a truck, man, like as long as I'm in a good house surrounded by good people, I'm gonna retire happy, man. there's no downside to it. So yeah, still being in the streets, but being able to also lead an entire firehouse and culture across those three shifts. To me, that's a sweet spot for me right now.
Okay. Now with you also being a captain, obviously you have a passion for this job ever since you're growing up in the firehouse with the people you surround yourself with. So with that being said, being a captain, how do you go about fostering like a culture of like, you want to have that crew that's dialed in? And for any captain or future aspiring captain listening, how do you go about that when you get to a house? I'm assuming when you get to a house, you kind of just sit back and read the room, see how they operate. But like, how do you get the men and women under you to be on the level that you want them to be, like your level?
Yeah. So I think there's two main drivers of that. And there's like sub layers and nuance to it. One is I have to live and lead the example. I have to be it. And then the second thing is having really clearly communicated expectations. I think there's two schools of thought. You sit back and you wait and you see how things operate. And then you kind of insert yourself like, "Hey, let's do these things." And the other one is like, "Hey, let's come out the gate hot. Thou shalt do this." I think I kind of toe the line a little bit. First day, I have basic expectations that I want everybody to live by and follow. So that way there's no guessing. And I also don't think personally, this is for me, that it's fair to, "Hey, you've been seeing us operate for like a month now, and now you want to come in and change things." From my experience, sometimes it doesn't always work out so well. So I come out the gate day one. I say, "Hey, guys and gals, like, this is what I expect of you. And this is what you can expect of me. And these are general things. I'm not asking you to change anything, but I'm going to say, I did a whole podcast on this where, and I'll just briefly speak on it. This is how the day is going to be set up, right? These are the priorities. This is how the day is going to be set up. And this is what I expect from you. And this is what you can expect from me. And here's how culturally I see us going." Now, I'm not asking them to make wholesale changes, because I know in the fire service culture, like, that doesn't, you know, work out well.
Right.
So I'm trying to find the balance between the two where we can all come up together. There might be a couple things, you know, everybody's going to have their ticks, which I totally get. But my whole goal from that is I don't want them to have to guess about what my priorities are. And a lot of that comes back to checking equipment, making sure things are right. Physical fitness, training, like, these are things that we will do, thou shalt do every single day. And that we can't really argue, because it all comes back to preparedness, bearing and demeanor, like, don't be a slob. When we go out to the community, it's community first. We're gonna have to deal with really hard things, really hard personalities. Sometimes tempers flare, but we still have to be presentable and respectful and professional to the community. And some of it is, I always kind of frame it with like, what's the right thing? Like, when you, and sometimes you just have to ask it out loud. And as soon as you do, it puts things back in perspective. And as soon as you say, like, we're faced with a hard decision, like, all right, well, what's the right thing right now? You 100% of the time always know what the right thing is. It's not usually an easy thing. It could be easy. It's simple, not easy. It's just the act of going through it. You know, maybe it takes more work, but if you frame everything that we do in this life with what's the right thing right now in this moment, we all know what the answer is. Like, okay, then let's just act on that. If it's more work, then it's more work, but it's the right thing. And we can always defend that. We can always rest our head on that. So I usually spend like 30 to 60 minutes coming out and setting those expectations. I kind of have a rubric that I've built up over the years from my experiences, and it's worked well for me. And then we can always change, modify. You know, I want to know what other people's responsibilities and expectations are and what things that they hold in high value. And we just kind of build it up together. It's like an open thing. I don't want to come in there and lay the hammer down, right? Like, we have to build a team culture, because that's what's going to happen when we're in a crazy situation on a fire round. They want to know that I have their back and they have mine. So we have to create that culture of trust like day one.
Fantastic. Okay. Love the answer. What does the term aggressive mean to you?
I like aggressive, but attainable, right? So aggressive is not, it's not hasty. I think so many people, you know, me coming from Kentland, like, we'd get called cowboys a lot. And I don't think it was necessarily fair. I think it was people that were maybe rocking back in their heels, maybe a little too much. So people, the community has a high expectation of us. And I do not think it is unreasonable. We need to be able to perform, because there is no backup option. Like, we are it. And when we get out there, we need to make their worst possible day a little bit better. So for me, if you're moving with a purpose and you are getting out ahead of other people, like, healthy competition breeds really high skill sets. It breeds a little bit more aggression from everybody else around you. And I think so many people think it's carelessness or it's haste. And in those instances, like, things are going to get missed. People are going to be in environments that they shouldn't be in. And that's not what I'm advocating for. It's quite the opposite. I'm not asking for everybody to be in search of medals, because that's not, should be at the forefront of our mind. But when you start reading other people's, and you look at the military for, you look at Medal of Honor recipients and you read their biographies, you're like, this man or woman was in a crazy situation, and they made situations that sometimes, or decisions that sometimes defy logic, but is what was needed in that moment, because it was the right thing, knowing full well that there was a great chance of personal harm or injury. It's a dangerous job. And so not every single incident can be framed that way. But when we start having that mindset of aggressive but attainable results, like, that's what I'm looking for. I'd rather pull back on the leash of my guys and gals a little bit than have to constantly say, no, come on, let's go, let's go. And that's what speaks to me, you know. And sometimes that doesn't always happen. You have to build those shifts up. But aggressiveness is not a naughty word, right?
Right. Right.
Like, it's totally okay.
Right. Okay. Okay. Love it. Let's see where I want to go. All right. So you said if you have to choose, you're definitely a truck kind of guy. And so with that being said, I don't want to say you're a subject matter expert, but I think you are. But written Mayday seems to be that's your jam. So
yeah,
can you elaborate a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So just based on some of my experiences with earlier in my career, with maybe some near misses or close calls, and being able to affect some change with the team that I had, or I'm just very fortunate to be friends with like professional dudes and women out there that have experienced some really crazy things, and be able to pick their brain and consult them and, or be mentored by them. I knew that from early on, you can do everything right in this job, and the fire ground is still indifferent to your capabilities, right? So it's always going to get a vote. Nature does not adjust your level of skill, and bad things may still happen. And so I started wrapping my mind around that and just started doing more training. Like, yes, make the problem go away. I love, you know, Ray McCormick's, you know, adage of we need a culture of extinguishment, right? Huge fan of that. And I agree with that. And then sometimes bad things may still happen. So as I started to prepare for it, I had amazing mentors that started running companies through drills like entanglements, and SCBA, like different air exchange emergencies. And then I had the opportunity to become an IAFF fire ground survival trainer. I was kind of one of the people that helped lead that charge through our union and bring that program into the county and build it up. And we started being able to handpick a lot of the initial trainers. We had the program come out and it was awesome. It was a great program. It's continued to build and grow over the years. And this was, you know, over 10 years ago now, I think. It didn't get wholesale buy-in immediately from the department. So then I would, whenever I was assigned to a company, I'm like, hey, I'm going through this entire program with you, whether you like it or not. I know it's going to come at some point. So let's run through these skills. And so I would just constantly do things like window bailouts, ladder bailouts, rope bailouts, entanglement scenarios, and SCBA confidence and different air exchanges. Like we were just trying to run through all these things, different drags and carries. And over time we're like, okay, cool. We're getting pretty fast with this. How do I find the next thing to stress you out? And so that's where some of that crawl, walk, run and stress inoculation started getting built into some of the things I was doing with my companies was let's find the high end of your skill set and let's start to stress that out now. They would do it for me. I would do it for them. Okay. And we just constantly kept growing and stressing things out. And we were becoming really fast and really skillful within the specific skill sets of like Mayday and firefighter rescue. And I did that with every company that I was assigned to, and it was always well received. We tried to remove as much fear from it. I think some people have seen training as like a punitive thing or a judgment-based thing. And right. That was always a core tenet of mine. A core principle was I want to remove the fear of judgment. I am not punishing you. It's okay to experience failure. We're going to do it. I'm going to do it. And that's going to be the best teacher for us. So that was one of my main driving factors originally, because sometimes when you say, hey, we're going to do this really crazy training, eyes glass over. I've had people like shake in fear. I've had people get teared up because prior assignments, you're going to be judged, or maybe they just didn't train. And so there was a new fear of like, I've been doing this job for a while and I don't know the skill. So very high priority of mine. Let's remove all that baggage and bullshit. Cause we're hitting the reset button now. We're all on the same level playing ground. And, it's all a lot of success. And I learned from a lot of other people, cause I thought I'd find the upper end of something. And one of the senior guys or gals would be like, hey, did you consider this? And it would totally rock everything that we were doing. Like, oh man, we never even considered that, and then run with it. And then we'd find a new thing, a new layer, a new rabbit hole to go down. And it was super awesome to have those in supportive environments. And quite honestly, I'd moved around a little bit. And in, you know, maybe this is a clean segue for you. Like in 2018, I was at an assignment in downtown Columbia. And for those familiar with the Maryland DMV area, I was assigned next to the firehouse to Meriwether Post Pavilion. It's a big concert venue where we're at. And that was the firehouse I was at. And it culminated, all that training culminated one night for our department's line of duty death in 2018 for Lieutenant Nathan Flynn. And we were stressed. We were taxed. We were pushed to the absolute limit. And it wasn't the result we all wanted, but we all at least made it out. And it validated the training and the experience and the physical fitness and everything that we were doing to push each other constantly every single day. And then that's what that, I think, combined with, unfortunately, somebody dying in the line of duty, we were like, okay, this is super huge and this is super important. We have to train the entire department. And so then that started spurring us bringing the program back with all the trainers, and we trained the entire department. And we didn't just do the IFF program. It's IFF. Then there was a Maryland program. And then we would find other things from other line of duties from around the nation. And we would throw those into the mix. We made our own Rittenhouse and we did our own Howard County things to throw curveballs into it. So it ended up being minimum 5 days. Sometimes we'd push it out to 8 days. Every single person had to do 5 to 8 days, 8 hour days of classroom lecture, basic skills, advanced skills, and then also doing basically a final culminating event where we just put you through the ringer and make you go through most of it, all in one fell evolution. And doing that now for all the recruit classes and all the people in the department, you know, those 5 day, you know, 8 hour days, 5 to 8 days at a time, you know, I'm probably coming close to a, you know, definitely over 600 people. It's probably closer to 800, nearing 1,000 now between the companies and all the recruit classes and then people retiring, all that stuff. So I'm very fortunate to have a lot of sets and reps and see the success and how that's built over the years. And then I just nerd out. So I see what other departments are doing. You know, I have friends in Baltimore City that I'm close with, and I pick their brains on what they're doing. I get to outside of the fire service, you know, it's something that we talked about in North Carolina. And I just look at the human psychology and the mental aspect of what we're going through and how that plays into our decision-making. So I've spent the last few years, 5 years, like really going down some deep rabbit holes and kind of pulling from all different areas. Cause it's not just Mayday. It's not just one skill. It's what is your mind going through? What's your body going through? How are you going to make decisions while in extremis environments? Right. And so, yeah, we kind of got handled a pile of shit that one night, and we're just trying to make something good of it, you know?
Totally understand. A couple questions I want to ask before leading into the main question. Everyone's heard crawl, walk, run, and it's good to train, but I think sometimes we should train to get personnel to experience that, I don't want to call it hyperness, but like, you know, when you do training, it's like, okay, I'm all right. I got to go do training. You do it, whatever, you're done. But training that starts getting your heart rate jacked up, that starts getting you just, you know, like we've all heard, the example, Captain Bowen out of Asheville, he was taxed to the point where like he wasn't acting right, you know. And I'm not saying we need to get people as they call it, to the black, but I feel like sometimes we need to push it up a notch, because when it comes to a real Mayday situation or I need help, like it's not comfortable, it's crap, like where am I at, what am I doing, my air, things like that. So my first question to you is physical fitness, it's got to play an important role in that.
100%. In all things that we do, we have to get comfortable being uncomfortable, simply put. And that's with physical fitness. That's with our training and our skill set. And physical fitness is kind of the base to what we do. And that's something that we talked about in North Carolina. And I'm trying to go out there and preach is that you can be the most physically fit firefighter, but if you don't have the emotional capacity to be able to handle the adrenaline side of it, your liability. And conversely, I've had people tell me, oh no, I got more experience. Like I can work efficiently. I'm good. I don't need to do this thing or this skill set. And like, bullshit, man. Like you can be the most experienced person in the world, but unless you're physically capable of being able to handle the physical rigor of this job, you are still a liability. Right. And I want anybody to be active. Like if you're out there active doing your thing or your sport or your specialty and something that speaks to you, that's awesome. My hat's off to you. That's necessary. I want to take it one step further though, and train in modalities that will replicate itself on the fire ground. And what I mean by that is if you're a marathon runner and you can hold a 5 minute pace for, you know, 20 some miles, that's amazing. But if you can't deadlift your own body weight and you can't drag your partner out of a building, you're still a liability. And if you are the bodybuilder or the power lifter and you can throw around 600 pounds of weight, but you can't run down the street without being out of breath, you are still a liability, right? We have to, it's the high intensity functional movement performed at high intensity. Like we are in these situations where we have tens and dozens of pounds of gear on our frame. Our mobility is limited. Our vision is limited. We have a finite amount of air on our back. We have to accomplish a lot of work in a little bit of time. And that is a big stressor on our joints, on our health, on our musculature. It's it's a hard job. So that's how we have to train, right? I want both those two worlds to combine. I want you to, you know, move large weights, long distances, and do it really quickly. And so that's how I've trained since probably 2007. I was on a couple calls that rocked me. I'm like, I need to change my training because I'm not cutting it on the fire ground. And when I had that, you know, chin check, I was like, all right, I'm going to change up to this. And a lot of people that have come up with me and have been assigned with me, we work out in that fashion. And it's been a game changer. And I can 100% say that has, beyond any question, that has saved me and my men's life on fire ground and on fire calls. And that aside, we also work more efficiently and can put more work in because we can do things, really hard things, really quickly. And I think so many people underestimate that. And that's fine. Like if you have a 20-year-old and you have a 40-year-old and you have a 55-year-old on your shift, it's all that level of fitness is all relative to you and your body and your age and what you're going through. I'm not expecting everybody to be a Spartan 20-year-old warrior.
Right.
But you can absolutely push the limits of who you are and what you are within your age bracket. And then I just want you to be a juggernaut within your own skill set and within your own abilities. And when we have a bunch of juggernauts on a team, like that's a wrecking ball, right? You're a force to be reckoned with, and you can accomplish a lot on the fire ground, and guarantee you it's going to save your damn life.
No, absolutely. Okay. I mean, like you said, physical fitness is the basis. I mean, that's where we need to start. That should be our focal point to get to a certain level. And I like how you, because, you know, there's probably some listeners out there that are like, well, you know, yeah, I can deadlift 500 pounds, but can you run a mile, like a straight mile, without being out of breath? And vice versa, marathon runners, can you at least lift your body weight? So you definitely have to find the balance in your workout.
Yeah. And a lot of the workouts, while they're not always in gear, it's not always about throwing ladders, right? I'm still going to replicate that in the gym. So yeah, I want you to go run a half a mile relatively as fast as you can. And then you're going to come back and you're going to deadlift your body weight 30 times. And then I'm going to have you take off on another half mile run. Maybe this time wearing a weight vest or something, or I'm going to have you carry a 70-pound dumbbell in each hand. And I want you to walk a quarter mile. Because that's a little bit more of what we see on the fire ground, right? Yes, there might be that one call where I need, you know, Johnny Bravo to deadlift 800 pounds. More often than not, though, I need you to be able to work quickly on the scene, get to the fire ground quickly, carrying all that damn gear that we've got. You know, we some of our riding positions, you're carrying 100 pounds plus of additional gear on your frame. Like our SCBAs are 36 pounds. Plus your gear, like you're already at 50, 60 pounds just in PPE. You haven't even picked up a tool yet. And then you pick up ladders and saws and forcible entry tools and or high rise racks. Like you're over 100 pounds, no problem. And then most civilians out there, like if you tell them to put on a 20-pound weight vest and do a workout, like they're crushed. We're asking you to wear 100 pounds of weight on your frame and go out there and just get to the scene. And then once you get there, I need you to do a 30 minutes worth of work on air and then come back out, recycle, and maybe do it again. Right. So that's when I want those two worlds to combine. And I can nerd out on some of the science of it. Like when we are on fire calls, we're generally working an anaerobic system. So that's where like naturally occurring sugars and naturally occurring creatine in your body are your energy sources. It's not oxygen. Like if you can hold a conversation, like on a jog, that's not the pathway. That's aerobic. That's the pathway that's being used to power that workout. Generally on a fire ground, when you are super taxed, it's hard to hold a conversation. It's one word answers. It's short sentences. We're doing a lot of work really quickly. That's the anaerobic system powering your workout. It's not long duration, but it's high power, high output. And so a lot of people don't train for that side of it. You know, if you're training in such a way that you can't hold a conversation and you can only give one word answers, you're probably doing the right thing because that's what the fire ground's going to look like, right? You know, when I talk on the radio, I got to take a couple breaths, calm myself down so I can get out a clear message that doesn't make me sound like I'm losing my breath and I'm going crazy, right? That's a spot to be in. And we want those workers on the fire ground.
Hey, you call it nerding out, but everything you said, I correlate to it. I'm like, awesome. I've done it. He's right.
Awesome.
Okay. With that being said, you were a part of the Nate Flynn rescue. So for the individuals who think I work in small town USA, this will never happen here. We don't run that many fires. If you can, I want you to explain that night when you were dispatched, what was going through your head and the rescue attempts that were made.
Yeah. So I'll, man, that's like a hour long conversation that I'll try to give you the cliff notes and the short version of. So the night of July 23rd, nasty storm came through. Lightning strike hit a mansion in the Howard County area, the south end of the county. And basically the corrugated CSST lines failed, arced, and started a fire. Small finger of flame in a crawl space in the home that built and ate away at the house for 30 minutes before anybody even knew it was on fire, right? So burn time before anybody got on scene was 30 to 40 minutes. And this was an 8,400 square foot home. So let's just say the standard American home is 2,000 square feet, right?
Right.
Just throwing out a ballpark number, right? You're talking four single families just in this one. It was one of the bigger ones, right? So 7,300 square feet of finished living space on floors one and two. The basement was 1,100 square feet. So there's your 8,400. Now here's the oddity. Underneath the main level of the home, but above the basement, so it was this weird middle offset layer, was a 1,000 square foot, 4 to 5 foot tall crawl space. It was underground, surrounded by block wall. It had multiple oil storage tanks. It had catering equipment, tables, chairs, all the kitchen equipment for parties of 60 plus people, all the decorations for all the holidays. It was like quarters conditions with like little small paths being able to be navigated. The first part of the box alarm, we got dispatched as a local box. So for us, that's basically two in one with some chiefs and ambos. They went in, they started doing work. They knew they had a working fire because they went on scene with smoke showing. They upgraded to a full box alarm and they had a real hard time finding the fire because it was in that crawl space that nobody knew about. Whenever you opened a basement door, the fire would kick up. You could see it on the main level. Whenever that door got controlled, fire would darken back down. Couldn't see it. Zero visibility. Had a hard time finding it. I was on the third DU engine, engine 71, coupled with truck 7. We were second truck, third engine. We get there once they upgraded to a full box alarm. And we were only there for a minute and 45 seconds before Nate Flynn fell into a hole and fell into the crawl space and maydays were sounded. So we knew the truck was going to be RIT. I teamed up with the truck. We kind of went around different sides of the home to put the full picture together since it was such a large home and we all met on the backside. And that's, like I said, it's a long story, but there were multiple grade changes. Side Charlie, you know, is almost 150 feet long on one side of the house, but there's grade changes. So even when you're at the lower level basement entrance, it still only looks like two stories. So that was confusion. Sides of the home is two stories from the front, but also two from the rear, but it was just like a custom weird built home. So when we said we're going into the basement, it was hard for command and other people to realize like, well, it's two stories from the front. Are they coming in the main level? But it, so just a lot of confusion about location and structure. So long story short, we figured out that it was Nate Flynn was the missing firefighter. Our crews went in. There were seven of us total, engine and truck. It was myself and Captain Love on the ladder truck were the two like RIT team leaders, essentially. And we had to search our way through this basement. We have one 300 foot attack line. And by the time we make it back to where the crawl space was, we had maybe 20 feet of line, 15 to 20 feet of line. So our charge line was on site alpha at one of the engines, went all the way around an 8,400 square foot structure on one side, back through side Charlie, all the way back to side alpha in the basement. And now we found a half set of steps to go to this crawl space. We didn't know it was a crawl space at the time. I thought it was a sunken living room because it's a mansion and it's maybe this crazy custom home. We had no idea what we were walking into. Once we entered the crawl space, we could hear Nate's pass device. You know, as clear as day, it was up ahead. And we went in to get them, and we had wires drop down on top of us. And so I'm thinking, I can swim under these wires. We can go get Nate. I wasn't able to get, or I was thinking, if I do that though, I got to bring Nate right back through all this mess. So I take out my cutters and I start cutting the wires away, and fire's kicking up, like high heat, low visibility, fires all around us. And I talked to my lineman, his nickname is Dreenie. He was kind of hunched over. It was kind of an awkward position. I had a little bit of light from all the fire. I was like, man, what's going on? I need you to knock this down, man. It's getting bad. And in one of the worst moments of his life, he calls me bro. He's like, bro, I'm stuck. And the nozzle stuck. He was wrapped so tight and the nozzle was wrapped so tight, he couldn't even open the bail of the nozzle. So cut him free. He starts being able to knock down fire. Truck captain starts getting caught up in the wires too. He's kind of getting hogtied. And as he's trying to turn and get out of our way, he's kind of getting tightened up in that. So we cut him loose. Other truck firefighters menu in. He starts clearing more of the wires out of the way. And I remember thinking, it's so bad in here right now. If we have to bail, I remember hearing near misses and line of duties where there's just too many people, mm-hmm. no place to bail. I remember thinking, hey, single stack on the steps for me. Like, if we have to bail, I don't want to bail into a bunch of like truck bodies. Like, if you could just get out. He's like, dude, I got it. I got the wires. Like, we're out of the way. You're ready to rock. Well, this whole time, my backup firefighter, Andy Hoffman, who's an amazing human being and firefighter, he had no idea any of this was going on. He kind of searched off to the right in the crawl space and then went up and got to Nate. He was ready. He had his air whip out. If he had to do any air exchanges, he packaged Nate, reseated him because he was face down in the middle of the crawl space. And we get up to him and we both grab a shoulder strap. I was like, hey, we're not doing air right now. Like, we got to get out of here. So we both start pulling and he doesn't budge, right? He's not moving anywhere. And I think the American male is like 18 inches across, like shoulder to shoulder. And now you got basically three of us in gear and basically a little tiny pathway in this crawl space with all the junk falling on us. So we're on all fours. We each grab a shoulder strap. I said, let's do this together. One, two, three, pull. And he moves. One, two, three, pull. He moves. And then we just do that all the way back to the entrance. We're tripping. We're falling. And Dreenie's still knocking down fire. Truck guys are like ready on the steps. They're helping clear stuff out of the way. They're ready for Nate to get passed off to him. And I remember thinking, like, we kept getting thrown so many curveballs, and a lot of them I didn't go over. Like, I could talk about this incident, like I said, for 90 minutes to really break down all the curveballs and all the things that were happening and all the things getting stacked against us. Like, no water being flown for over an hour. One of the engines on scene, their pump took a crap and went out of service. Like, there's just all kinds of things going on. I remember thinking, emotionally and physically, I'm utterly taxed being in a high heat environment, like pulling lines, searching, dragging what is going to be your dead comrade out of this building. And I'm at 95% of my overall capacity. And I remember thinking, we're getting thrown so many curveballs. I'm going to save 5% more in case we get thrown another curveball for me and my guys. Otherwise, like, I'm taking it to the red line right now. And we get out, we pass them on to the truck crew, Carlos Brown and Munn. Carlos Brown takes him out into the rest of the building, through the steps utility room, gets him out into the basement. And man, when we hit the steps, all of our bells start ringing in unison. So now, like, all right, we're down to our last third of air, and we still got to make it out of an 8,400 square foot home with Nate. We all file out of the crawl space. We get into the basement. I see Nate on the ground again, cause we're all physically just smashed. And so the truck guys had to take a breather. I grab Nate thinking I can get him out the rest of the way. And I'm a fit dude. Like, I got this. He doesn't move an inch. We had a secondary team in police. They came and got him. Rich Blankenship, he got Nate out the rest of the way and onto his own awaiting crew. So Nate was a member of Special Ops, our Station 10. Our paramedic 105, his own guys, Ryan Glenn and others, like, immediately took care of him, downdressed him, started doing ALS efforts. And then through eyewitness reports and then from the burn data that NIST had, we're estimating probably 60 seconds, maybe 90 seconds. As we entered, excuse me, as we exited the crawl space, the rest of that crawl space collapsed. So I don't sit there to say that to prey on emotions or be like, look what we did. I say that to say, if your physical fitness was not at the level that we were at, if we didn't have the experienced members that we did, if we didn't constantly drill, like I'm talking like the backup line or our line that we had, if we were not managing turns and curves correctly, if we spent more time on the entanglement, if we didn't search appropriately, we can add seconds to all those skills super easy. Super easy. Like if we were not Johnny on the spot that night with our entire team, we could have easily been in that structure for one more minute and potentially had seven more dead or injured firemen. And so, like, again, I'm not trying to prey on emotions here. I'm just saying that that is the reality of the situation, is that that's where that aggressiveness comes back into play, right? If we were lazy about our search, if we didn't manage our line, if we didn't have the skill set to effectively handle the entanglement, if we weren't physically fit enough to get Nate out, we would have spent more time in that structure. But we kind of defied the odds that night. And we have the data to prove it too through our SCBA data. And when you look at like national averages, what our bodies and minds experienced that night and went through, and when you look at our air usage, it defies what we see throughout the rest of the nation. And I applaud my guys for that because they were out there putting in the sweat equity while we're on the engine bay floor and while we're in the weight room. And that, like, all those components is what saved our lives that night and what was able, it gave us the ability to bring Nate out. It's not the end that we wanted. They ended up pronouncing him at the hospital. He passed away from hyperthermia. And it's a tough story, but we made it out and we're trying to use this situation for good and use our experiences and our training and our mindset to, like, you know, hey, this is what got us out of a bad situation. You know, maybe hopefully you can use it too. Use it for good.
Right. Man. Yeah. First off, thank you for having a, I don't want to say relive that, but with you talking about it, you are kind of reliving everything, all the moments through your head. And one thing I want to add first off is, from what I've gathered talking to other people, Nate Flynn wasn't just a regular firefighter. He wasn't just there for a paycheck. Like he was one of those firefighters you would want coming for you. Like he was jam up into the job.
Yeah, Nate and I went to the academy together, man. I've known him since 2005, and we were very different people back then. You know, all of us, you know, almost 20 years ago, like we were very different people. But he spent his career curating and cultivating events to make him a better firefighter. He was a member at Station 7 for a little while where I was at. He was a member of the Special Ops team. He himself became an FDIC instructor. You know, he spent time putting his money where his, you know, his money where his mouth was. You know, he held up his end of the bargain, and bad things still happen. And we can Monday night quarterback it all we want. What happened happened. And you know, like I said before, like you can do everything right and bad things can still happen to you. And that's kind of what happened that night. And he leaves behind five children and a wife. And shout out to his wife Celeste. And their group, the Phoenix Advocates, they've done more for the fire service than most men and women who've put in a 20-year career have could ever think of, you know, changing laws and regulations, supporting training endeavors. And to Celeste's credit, she has a slogan now called Commit Your Six. And Commit Your Six is from SCBA data, Apple Watch data, radio data. We know that as soon as Nate fell into that hole, he spent the next 6 minutes of his life drawing on every ounce of training energy he had to try to save his life. And so I'm just trying to echo his wife's message to say that, you know, there's a lot of times in this job where we just want to kick our feet up. If you, for nothing else, she asked that you at least spend 6 minutes just trying to make yourself 1% better. If Nate can do that in the worst moment of his life, we can spend 6 minutes trying to make ourselves 1% better any way we can. So I'm just trying to echo that message as well.
Well, the message. The message should make you think. Like,
It's
I
heavy.
mean, you know, 6 minutes. Like, you know, most departments allow 1 hour of PT time, and yet we still have individuals who It's like 1 hour. I really got to go out and do this, or let's go do some training. I really got to go out and train. I've been on for 10 years. I really got to go pull this cross leg. Like, I just want people to actually understand how everything comes full circle. Like, the fire department is not, it's definitely not a joke, but it's not an ordinary 8 to 5 job. Because, like, there's always comparisons of us and athletes. But to me, the main takeaway is athletes prepare for game day. We don't know when our game day is. We go to work
100%.
and it's like, oh man, I'd love to go to a job today. Sure, okay. But you don't know when that'll be. It's not like we can, all right, 3 o'clock, we're gonna have this job. It can come at any moment, any time, and you can be faced with any crazy situation out there. So what I'd like to hit on too is a couple questions. You and the truck company that were working together, you guys were operating on one cylinder before you started hitting the bell. Like, did any of you guys get bumped with a writ pack?
No, yeah, one cylinder. We had one cylinder, and from that amount of work, I'd say I was just looking at the data the other night when I was training on it. We have 4,500 PSI cylinders. We got down below 2,000. I think we were right at our 1,500 to 1,000 PSI of air left. We were on air for, I think it was close to 25 minutes total. There's a couple times where we were about to go in, came off air to save air, and then I had our whole operation. So total time inside the structure just for the writ and Mayday was extraction was 15 minutes and 5 seconds across 7 people. And then, like I said, there was a couple other minutes of air time. So close to 20 minutes of air time, about, we'll just ballparking at 3,000 PSI of air on one cylinder. And when you look at our SCBA data, it's just a clean 45 degree drop, no big dips, no waves. That's everything from searching, pulling hose lines, entanglement, like our own personal Maydays, to the hardest metabolic thing I've ever done of pulling a fully geared, your dead buddy out of a building, and bringing them back out. That's physically and emotionally one of the hardest things I've ever done. And we still had air in our tanks when we came out. Whereas there were other people on scene, when you look at the SCBA data, and this is where I start going into the research of here's a physically fit firefighter, but somebody that's not emotionally regulated, and this is their air usage. Here's somebody that is a genius and a professional of the fire service, and I would trust my life with them. Maybe not the most physically fit, this is what their data looks like. And here's somebody that's both. They're not physically fit, they're not experienced, and look at their air usage and air time. And when you start combining those factors, it's called the amplifying effect of physical plus adrenaline-induced stress. It wreaks havoc with your body. And so the only thing that is going to decide whether or not you make it out of these situations unscathed is your upfront investment and the training you've put in and working out physically demanding ways. And then also eventually building up the skill set to also stress yourself out in gear and work these skills. Because that adrenaline-induced response, like we said, it can make you go to condition black. Written Mayday, your air usage goes up by about 50% on average. Heart rate can go well above your max theoretical heart rate of 220 minus your age. So for me, I think max theoretical is somewhere around 180. I was definitely over 180 for parts of that. I've got data where some of my friends who are physically fit, the most experienced firemen in the nation, and they have heart rates up at, 190 above. That's above your max theoretical heart rate. So what our minds and bodies are going through, man, cannot be understated. And when we don't have these people that want to put in the upfront investment that is required over a 20, 30 year career, it's a liability. It's a liability for you, for your families, for your peers. And we had people on that call that were 8 months in on the job, and we had people that were getting ready to retire within a couple months or within the year. The truck captain, Captain Love, he was in the middle of the shit with us, holding up his end of the bargain, and he was retiring in about a year, and he had over 30 years in the fire service. So it doesn't matter what part of your career, what stage of life you're in. if you're running calls and you're in gear, you have got to be prepared. And I'm not saying, again, you have to be the 25-year-old Spartan, but you have to push the envelope of what you individually are capable of, so you are a member of the team that can provide for the team. We saw it firsthand, but every single person on our company set the tone, set the example, lived the example. We're disciplined in our craft, and every shift we worked out, we trained, we stressed ourselves to the point to where we knew that we were doing really hard things and had a high skill set. And not every day can look like that. You can't stress your body and mind out every single day. That's not what I'm advocating for. But at times you need to get to that point. Because the first time you experience that should not be on the fire ground, because that's when it's going to go bad.
Definitely. That part right there. Yes. I mean, we should all, and like you said, I mean, I don't want to like repeat what you said, but no, you don't need to match yourself out all the time. But no. If you're going to do it on the training ground. That way, whoever's instructing can go, okay, this is what you're experiencing. All right. Get down to a calmness, do some sort of breathing technique, and then focus on whatever task at hand. What I kind of like to do, and I heard this, I can't remember who I heard it from, so I apologize, but whenever I'm like, all right, I feel like I'm getting maxed out, I ask myself a dumb question, like, what's my address? Because it's like, you make your mind like kind of stop and focus. Because like I've heard where when individuals get to a certain point and you ask them something simple, like what's 4 + 4? They cannot answer it because they're out there. So that's what I kind of like to do. But what really kind of drives home to me is the fact that, you know, I'm 39. I'm not, when I got hired at my department, I was 22. 39 and 22, man, that's a big difference.
That's like, a big swing. Yeah, sure.
I wake up in the morning and I'm like, okay, I'm hurting a little bit, you know, and it's,
I feel that.
I put that in my head of like, this is a young man and women's game. For but sure. As you go up in age, it doesn't mean you can let fitness slide. And yes, you don't need to go out there and do some, you know, as you get older, you gotta go with how your body goes, but I'm going to try to go as hard as I can, safely as I can, because it's what's required. It's like the basic requirement.
Yeah. No, I love what you said there. It is what is required. No exception. Right. One of my captains who retired after 43 years, when he first got on the job, I've got this great clip where he said, he's being sat down. They look at the job description. He said, all right, you read through this. And he said, if you do everything in this job description perfectly, every single day without fail, you are average. Don't be average, because what we expect of you, what the community expects of you, the things that we experience do not require average. You have to go beyond that. And that's what's going to, as a leader, I need to set that tone and example. And there's that individual leadership of just having the awareness of, where am I at? Where do I need to go? But whatever's in the job description, man, that's basic level requirements. So how do we advance that? How do we push beyond that? Because like you said, that is what is required. You know, we don't get a vote. Like you said, we don't know when it's coming. And nature doesn't adjust to our level of skill. I know I keep repeating myself. I just love that freaking quote, man, because it's so true. It is so true.
You're right. Because so many people tend to think we will rise to the, I'm probably going to butcher, but like we will rise to the level of whatever we're facing. And it's usually not that's a false sense of security.
Yeah. That rise to the occasion, but you sink to the level of your training.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Oh man.
Yeah. And that training, man, like you can't just get it right once. And that's something else we do is no. I need you to do this with enough volume and repetition to where this is second nature. You can't just get it right once and be like, cool, slap hands. No, you got to keep going. And then that becomes second nature. Awesome. Now it's second nature. Now I'm going to stress you out. You're going to go do a lap around the building in gear. You're going to go take a sledgehammer and hit a tire for 10 swings on each arm. And then you're going to farmers carry a bunch of weight. And now we're going to start. And it's amazing to watch people who haven't experienced that, especially for like air exchange, when we do air emergency stuff, they might have a minute to do whatever that skill is under normal conditions. But as soon as I get their heart rate up and breathing rate up, seconds, they go from 1 minute to seconds of being able to run out of air because, excuse me, they've never experienced that stress and that timing of my heart rate's up, my breathing rate's up, because a lot of people don't train like that. But as soon as you get that stress response into play, then the fear starts up. And I see that like, oh shit, I just went from 60 seconds. Now I only have 5 seconds to complete this evolution before I run out of air. Doing like a buddy breathing connection or whatever, immediate game changer. And I've seen people panic and freak out, and we manage that, and we do it in a safe way and a trusting way. So that way it's, I'm like, hey, dude, I celebrate that. Like, I'm glad that happened. It's okay. It's happened to me too. Now you know where your upper limit is. You know what that is. So let's find ways to streamline your skill set so we can get that skill done within your time domain. And until you experience that, it's a game changer. People take it for granted. So that's where we're starting to combine the tactile skill with that physical stress. And we did that with each other on our teams, man. And I fully attribute that being a portion of what saved us that night.
That's like, I have no words. I have no words, but, but thank you for sharing that. Because like, I mean, like I said, you know, whoever's listening, they need to, like, I'm sure they can visualize everything that you said, because I know I did, and hopefully it can kind of hit home or drive the phone of, you know what, I have been kind of lax, because everybody has different seasons in life. But when you show up to work, like, that can't be, you can't use your career job as like a part-time thing. Like when you're there, you're all in. You got to be all in, because at one time you slack off and think, hey, you know, it's going to be an easy day. That's when shit usually hits the fan, or you're running a bunch of calls and you're like, man, where did this come from? And, you know, with most Maydays, there's always one thing that is just a domino effect of this going bad, that going bad, that going bad.
Yeah.
All the research has shown that. So, you know, complacency, people that are complacent, like, just, I just want people to think like, maybe what I'm doing, I need to change things, because we never know. You know, Nate Flynn, he's an example. Jermichael Mueller is another example. Like, dialed in dudes where stuff just goes bad, unfortunately.
Right. It's the nature of our profession, man. You absolutely nailed it. Sometimes we just don't know, and you can do everything right and we're still going to get caught. So how do we overcome those situations? Military circles do it. Elite attack, law enforcement and military units do it. You know, we need to also do that. We're in extremist environments. So we need to learn what that feels like and how to overcome it. Can't be understated, man. I appreciate that.
No. Thank you. On a lighter note, lighter topic, Forged and Unbroken. I want you to talk about what that is for individuals out there who might not know. And if anybody wants to contact you, because I'm not sure if they know, but like, you are a, I don't want to butcher the title, but you're a physical fitness coach or a trainer instructor.
No, I appreciate the opportunity to talk on that. So, on my days when I'm not in the firehouse, I am a CrossFit level 2 certified coach. I've been CrossFitting since 2007. I've been coaching since March of 2011. So I got over a decade of training time. I'm also an ACE peer fitness trainer. So when I'm not in my community at Odin CrossFit in Frederick, Maryland, hanging out with amazing people and coaches doing that, I'm also doing it for the department, for the wellness committees. And that's something near and dear to me. So I've been doing it a long time, and it's been an awesome experience. And like I said, it's been the skills that have not only saved my life, but it's also allowed me to create relationships and build teams that have bought into it. And we have all seen our physical fitness and wellness increase because of the CrossFit methodology. It is what replicates the fireground, and beyond a shadow of any doubt, it has absolutely saved my life, not just on Woodscape, but on other calls. And I can work so much more efficiently before I was able to, when I was a younger firefighter, you know, doing the buys and tries, right? And then with Forged and Unbroken, just being thrust into some of the situation, people were always asking me like, man, what do I do with this? What do I do with that? You overcame this, and having these conversations is amazing. It started out as a podcast idea. So I do have my own podcast with Forged and Unbroken, and we cover a lot of topics. We cover mental health and the things that my crew and I went through on the mental health side of things. We talk about the incident. So if you want to do a deeper dive on the incident, we talk about it on the podcast, and there's a couple others out there. We talk about physical health. We talk about leadership. I want to know about people's maydays and near miss scenarios that they've been involved in, and talk about the human element of what they're going through. So that's what a lot of the podcast is. You know, there's nothing off limits with that. There's also an online community with Forged and Unbroken through a Patreon. And for a cup of nice coffee a month, it's $6 a month. What we do is I have 6 days a week I post a workout that you can do in a gym or even at home. If you got a sandbag or a dumbbell or a kettlebell, like, you can still do all these workouts, minimal equipment. Or if you got a full blown gym, you can do the full thing. So 6 days a week, you get a workout. On Monday, I do what's called a growth mindset podcast. It's like anywhere from 3 to 10 minutes where I start breaking down a topic from either my experiences or my research and readings. I go out to other industries and I put the fire service spin on it to make us better and kind of help us zoom out and become more efficient with our jobs and professions. On Fridays, I do mobility work. I'm a mobility nerd, and musculoskeletal injuries are huge in the fire service. So every Friday I do
mobility videos. It's everything from just making your body feel better to doing injury prevention, injury rehab. So that's every Friday. I post a video on that. Like, here's a quick 2 to 5 minutes. Here's something to give you better range of motion with your shoulders. Here's something to reduce back pain. Here's something to allow you to operate your cylinder better because your shoulder mobility is now fixed. So that's every Friday. And then Wednesdays, you either get early access to the public podcasts that I do, or you have, I'll post research from other areas, and that could be leadership, that could be fire service based. It's a wide net. So I'm just trying to create awareness on as many levels as I can, physical, mental, emotional performance. And then whatever money's generated, total revenue, like, I take a third right off the top, and then quarterly I donate to charities, public safety charities and causes. So that money's going right back to good causes. And then I also do a give back to any members on the Patreon as well. You know, sometimes it's t-shirts and swag, sometimes it's like small fire equipment, but just as like a thank you for being a member. So I also go out and do speaking engagements as time allows. You know, family and my girls, my wife, my two daughters are the most important thing. But if I have time to get away, sometimes I'll come out and speak about some of the experiences and the research that I've done as well. So, I'm on Instagram. That's where a lot of my stuff is. You know, I'm always posting some research or little tidbits, clips from the podcast, workout ideas, and why these workouts are necessary for some of the Mayday data that's out there and what our bodies are going through. So, Forged and Unbroken, man, it's a wide net. I cover a lot of different ground. But it's, I'm not saying it's an untapped resource, but it's something that's near and dear to me with the mental and physical performance of what our bodies and minds are going through in these crazy environments. So that's been my niche here over the last year.
Okay. And if anybody wants to reach out to you to get you to talk about that incident and the data that you have that I was able to see in Greensboro, how can they do that?
Yeah. So the Instagram handle is Forged and Unbroken Fire. My email is forgedandunbrokenfire@gmail.com. Those are the two best methods to get a hold of me. I answer 100% of my stuff. Sometimes it just takes a couple of days with work and family stuff, but it's just a matter of time. I will absolutely get back to you. And I've had some really awesome conversation with some great people out there.
So. And I can attest to the listeners. I'm telling you, his presentation, it's easy for us to talk about it, but until you can physically see the PowerPoint slides with your eyes that shows the physical activity, the exertion from the Scott Pack data, the Apple Watch data, all the data that they have accumulated from that incident, it should make you think, like, where am I at? Because I know I was like, where would I be at if something like that happened? So implore you to please, if your department wants some outside speakers, some outside guests, please reach out, because it was a phenomenon. I'm not trying to blow. I told him himself after his presentation, presentation, his PowerPoint was phenomenal. So I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Dude, thank you so much. And to you, Danny, and to anybody else that's listening, if you are comfortable enough with sharing data with me, I'm on a mission right now to get as much data as I can. And what I mean is, if you have Apple Watch data, any SCBA nowadays, you can pull the air usage charts from it. If you just go to one of your techs, if you wear a Whoop bracelet or an Aura ring that records your metabolic data, and if you've been involved in a rescue, if a near miss, a mayday, a line of duty, and you have crazy metabolic data or air data that you can get, and you are comfortable sharing that with me, I'm trying to compile as much as I can, because I'm trying to put that good word out about what our bodies and minds are going through. I've already had a handful of people share their stuff with me. I'll keep it at 100% anonymous, or I'll give all the credit and accolades and backstory. It's whatever you're comfortable with. I want to be respectful to that as much as possible. But anybody out there, if you've got data, man, I want to see it, and I want to use it for good. Because what I'm already seeing for, I've got stuff from Maydays. I got a couple from Maydays, from line of duties, just from house fire rescues, pulling people out, and what our bodies are going through is insane. Like, we're above max heart rates. We're above strain levels of general populations. And we're doing this under stress, under extreme conditions, in gear. I think it's really going to create a ton of awareness and kind of flip the conversation on what our bodies and minds are going through. So anybody out there listening, man, if you don't mind sharing that with me, I would be so honored. Because what I'm seeing right now is just unreal. And you got some of that from the presentation. And just from that presentation, another person reached out to me with some stuff. So anything out there, man, it would be an honor. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for allowing me that opportunity to speak on that.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for coming on and talking what I call the gospel, spreading the good word, letting others know it's okay to want to be good at this job. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to come do this.
Oh, dude, thank you, Danny, man. It was an honor meeting you down in North Carolina. Thank you for putting out the good word and giving me the opportunity, man. I'm sure, we've just started to rub elbows here. I'm sure this will be the beginning of just a lot of spitballing back and forth. So I appreciate this, man. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, bro.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.